Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When Liza Monroy decided to get married in her early 20s to a man who could never be with her completely, she didn't care. Her husband needed her in ways only she could provide. Malin Ackerman of the Showtime series Billions reads us Liza's essay, "Elvis and My Husband Have Left the Building."
My ex-husband is gay, and I knew it when I married him. We were only 23 at the start of our promising careers, but he, alas, was at the end of his student visa. So I married Ricky to keep him from being sent back to his gay-intolerant Muslim homeland, where he'd have to live a life of lies, secrecy, and fear. I acted out of love, no compensation requested or received. We simply got in the car, drove northeast out of Los Angeles, and 5 hours later, Elvis was singing, "I'm in love, I'm all shook up," as we danced down the aisle of the little white wedding chapel. Me in a hot pink slip dress and my groom in his brown leather jacket, ribbed cream turtleneck, and khakis. When we reached the altar, the Elvis impersonator stopped his hip-swinging jig. "Do you promise to polish each other's blue suede shoes?" I beamed at my almost husband. "I do." "Do you promise to walk each other's hound dogs?" "Of course," Ricky said. "I'm more of a cat person," I replied. "But sure." It was over in 5 minutes, but nobody could say our love wasn't genuine. It might have been more genuine, of course, if Ricky had been standing next to the preferred love of his life, a man. But a man wouldn't have been able to help him the way his best girlfriend could. I first noticed Ricky 4 years earlier in college, when he walked into our advanced film production workshop. He was hard not to notice with his wild black hair and coffee-colored cashmere turtleneck that matched his eyes. Our friendship was born over donuts and coffee at 5 a.m., freezing on a Boston street corner as we prepared to shoot our first exterior. After graduation, we moved to Los Angeles and rented a place together in West Hollywood, the land of shirtless men. Ricky got an internship on a studio lot while I freelanced in the art department of a company doing hip-hop videos. We were constantly lost in the San Fernando Valley during our trips to IKEA or to sign up for Central Casting. But domestic life was sweet. Ricky cooked his famous spaghetti sauce for me whenever I'd have a rough day. And I helped him shop for ties for his job interviews and drove him around when his car wouldn't start. But once Ricky's internship ended and he could no longer claim student status for his visa, he discovered that no entertainment company would sponsor him for a work visa. Now, I'd told Ricky many times I would marry him if he ever had any visa trouble, and he'd never taken me seriously. I'm not sure I took myself seriously either. But now, as he explained his grim situation over drinks at our favorite bar, it suddenly became a reality. True to my word, I gulped my cocktail, got down on my knees, and proposed. He hopped off his bar stool, knelt beside me, and took my hands. I'd be honored to be the envy of straight men everywhere. "Straight men," I said, looking around. "Where?" Over the following weeks, like the engaged couple we were, we mapped out our finances and strategized about whom to tell and how much. Ricky called his father in the Middle East and told him we were marrying for the green card. And his father, who of course didn't know Ricky was gay, actually hoped we'd fall in love during the process. I decided not to tell my mother, who lived in Europe and wasn't likely to find out. Or so I thought. I was nervous but happy. I was marrying Ricky not only so he could pursue his American dream, but also because I needed him. And my love for him, though not sexual, made our marriage feel authentic to me. What's strange is that even though our arrangement was unconventional, I started to have rather conventional expectations of Ricky. I expected him to pay the bills, to be there for me, and to come home at a decent hour. At times, it seemed the only difference between our marriage and a real one was that we weren't having sex. Then again, maybe that didn't set us apart from a lot of straight couples. But still, I wondered, does love without sex count as marriage in the eyes of the law? On occasion, we even talked about what a perfect child we could have if we were to go the artificial insemination route. Newly armed with his work permit, Ricky edited movies as a freelance and worked part-time at a restaurant while I landed a job in the mailroom at a talent and literary agency. Occasionally, I'd forget I was actually married, but reality hit every time I filled out an employee form and had to check the married box. I felt like I was playing some kind of bizarre joke. Word got out at my office that I was married, and I couldn't deny it. While some of my colleagues knew the truth, others thought I had a real husband and had just married young. Scandal ensued when I fell for a coworker and we began dating. "You shouldn't date him," Ricky said. "We have to maintain appearances." He was right. But unfortunately, he didn't do such a great job of this himself. He went out nearly every night partying with different guys, and 6 months into our marriage, Ricky still didn't have a full-time job, which finally led to a stereotypical married argument one evening when I came home to find him watching The Simpsons instead of looking online for jobs as he'd promised. "I did this for you," I lectured, sounding just like my mother. "What are you doing for yourself? With freedom comes responsibility." After our fight, Ricky managed to get hired full-time at the film editing company. "You're my wife," he told me. "I need to make you happy." And things were better until one weekend when I was color coordinating my wardrobe and Ricky knocked lightly at my door. "Which should go first after the whites?" I asked him. "Sweetie, I have to tell you something, and I don't know how you're going to react." "When have you ever not known how I'll react? You know me better than I do." "This is different. The other day I went to get tested, just a routine thing. I went numb." "Tested?" He came over and hugged me. "I was in that examination room for 45 minutes, and when I came out, my friend Jeffrey was already crying. He knew they don't keep you in there unless something's wrong." He held my shoulders and looked at me. "You're not going to ask for a divorce?" "I can't believe you'd think that." But I wondered, what would this mean for us? And what would it mean for his chances at the green card? Before we could sort it all out, Ricky got a stunning email message. He'd won the green card lottery, a government visa program with fewer requirements. I couldn't believe the paradox. After all we'd done, our marriage, our secrecy, our sacrifices, his green card in the end had more to do with luck. It had nothing to do with me. We were free to divorce immediately, but we didn't. Instead, we moved to Manhattan. We were used to our situation, and we dreaded starting up another round of paperwork, lawyers and bureaucrats. Besides, being married had its advantages, especially when it came to getting an apartment in New York. The broker treated us like serious candidates instead of the low-income people in our 20s we were, and we snagged a charming two-bedroom in a great neighborhood. In our new life, Ricky and I went every morning before work to a nearby cafe for Mexican coffee and fresh fruit. The one time I went for coffee without him, the cashier asked me where my boyfriend was. "He's not my boyfriend," I said. "He's gay." "Oh, thank God you know," she exclaimed. "Here I was thinking that poor girl, her boyfriend's gay and she doesn't even know it." I knew it all right. I also knew things were changing between Ricky and me. I'd run into an old boyfriend and we'd started seeing each other. And Ricky had also started dating someone new. Still, we didn't divorce. A new boyfriend was one thing. A Manhattan co-op board was quite another. My mother and I had decided to buy an apartment together. She was still in Europe but wanted a place of her own when she visited New York, and I was ready to live on my own. We found a place and got all the way to the interview with the board members before it occurred to me that Ricky's name was all over my tax returns. If my mother found out about the marriage during the conference call with the board and threw a fit, we'd lose the apartment. I had to tell her. But first, I called Ricky. The co-op board will need to know you don't have any rights to the property. We need to file for divorce. I paused. I'm sorry it has to end this way. It's okay, he said. It had to happen sometime. The very next day, Ricky took care of the paperwork. He said he was the only one in line at divorce court, happily humming along to his iPhone. The reason I filed, according to the report he completed on our behalf, was neglect. Legalese for his lack of performance in bed. The conversation with my mother was not as cheery. Who got married? She yelled. To Ricky? Don't worry, I said. We're divorced now. Oh, you'd better be divorced. I swallowed. Just so you know, it was my idea to get married. For his green card? I thought for a moment, then told her the truth. Mom, I married him because I wanted to. Now, almost 2 years later, Ricky has good doctors and is healthy and thriving. I'm married again to the old boyfriend I ran into. He isn't an American either, but he's straight, and he's already established in his career. It is the most conventional of all marriages, complete with actual sex and plans for babies down the line. The only unconventional thing I do anymore is go out with my ex-husband for shopping and pedicures. How many divorcees can say that?
Malin Ackerman reading Liza Monroy's essay, Elvis and My Husband Have Left the Building. We'll hear more from Malin later in the episode, but first we've got an update from Liza. You'll hear that after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We caught up with Liza Monroy not too long ago, and much has happened since she penned this essay in 2005. Turns out she divorced her second husband, the one she mentions at the end of the essay. He wasn't a U.S. citizen either, and before they finalized their divorce, he had one last request.
He asked me if I would do him one favor and stay married to him until his green card was official. So I call that the real marriage that turned fake.
But Liza says, third time's a charm. She married her now husband in 2013, and guess who walked her down the aisle?
And it was Ricky on one arm and my mother on the other arm, which sort of tied everything up in a stranger-than-fiction way, since she was her job, her career in the Foreign Service, fighting immigration fraud, basically put her at odds with my marriage to Ricky the whole time because she believed it was fake and fraudulent, whereas I argued that if we loved each other and the only thing we didn't have in our relationship was sexual, then was that saying that only sex defined a real marriage? and we had many conversations about it, she came to finally see it a little bit more aligned with as I did.
Liza and her husband have a young daughter and live in Santa Cruz, California. Ricky is healthy and thriving. He lives in New York City with his partner.
They shared a common office building and they met in an elevator there, actually. And they have been together now for over 10 years. And Ricky did decide ultimately a few years ago to come out to his family. And he planned it so that he would go home to visit and then be getting a ride to the airport. And as he was getting out at the curb of the airport to fly back to the States is when he would tell his father that he was gay. So he did that and he immediately walked out, got on his plane, went home. And his father gave him the silent treatment for a while and then also then later went through the denial stage and said, like, oh, it's probably because you moved to America, you're experimenting. And then after that, a few years later, he surprisingly came around and accepted Ricky, and not only accepted him, but his partner as well. So that was something that back when we were both kind of keeping secrets from our parents, he was keeping his sexuality a secret, I was keeping our marriage a secret. So we both had these secrets, and in the end, after they came out, to use the term, things went better than we could have imagined, though by no means did it happen overnight.
Liza Monroy. Her memoir about her marriage to Ricky is called The Marriage Act. Her latest book is a collection of personal essays. It's called Seeing As Your Shoes Are Soon to Be on Fire. Stick around. We'll hear from Daniel Jones in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says this piece has stayed with him.
I'm always fascinated by stories where something that begins as an unconventional relationship, you know, pretty soon takes on all the trappings of a conventional relationship. And, you know, this is a strange, out-of-the-box marriage. And yet, you know, living with someone is living with someone. And I see time and time again that once you're living together and trying to make decisions together, you fall into roles, you irritate each other in the same sort of stereotypical ways. But I'm endlessly fascinated by it because people are always wanting to know, you know, how do we do a relationship different? How do we do it in some progressive way? How do we do that better? And the answer is you don't do it better. You know, you end up living with someone is hard, living with someone for 2 decades or 5 years or 10 years. You know, it's hard and you can try, but chances are you will fall into roles that maybe you resent and maybe you feel embarrassed by. But in this case, you know, affection often wins the day anyway. And it's ultimately just a very sweet story in that way.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Many thanks to our reader this week, Malin Ackerman. She says this essay really made her think about the ways we define our relationships.
I love the question that she asks herself that, you know, is this a real marriage? Because there's love there, even if they're not having sex. And I think that's such an interesting question. this is just such a beautiful story of a girl and her best friend who love each other so much and pick each other up and save each other and have such a beautiful, unique relationship. It just spoke to me.
Mollyn Ackerman. You can see her now in season 2 of the Showtime series Billions. Next week on the podcast, Paul Rust of the Netflix comedy series Love tells us why those riveting first date conversations about weather and traffic need to go.
Why can't we replace small talk with big talk and ask each other profound questions right from the start? Replace mindless chatter with a conversation about our weightiest beliefs and most potent fears. Questions that reveal who we are and where we want to go.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.